From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Terry Garr made her movie debut opposite Gene Hackman in The Conversation and went on to prominent roles in Young Frankenstein, Tootsie, and Close Encounters of the Third Kind. She started her career as a dancer and danced in 9 Elvis films, The Sonny and Cher Show, and Shindig. Her mother was an original Rockette. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Garr about her new memoir, Speed Bumps. It covers her life, her career, and her diagnosis of MS. In 2002, she announced that she had the disease, but the symptoms started years before she was diagnosed. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Jelly Roll Morton, The Complete Library of Congress Recordings by Alan Lomax. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. She danced in 9 Elvis movies, made her screen debut opposite Gene Hackman in The Conversation, played the doctor's assistant and girlfriend in Young Frankenstein, and was nominated for an Oscar for her supporting role in Tootsie. My guest is Terry Garr. She's written a new memoir called Speed Bumps. The biggest speed bump she writes about is multiple sclerosis. In 2002, she announced on TV that she had MS. The symptoms had begun years earlier, but it took a long time to get an accurate diagnosis. Before we talk about her health, let's hear about the movies that made her famous. Here's a scene from the 1982 film Tootsie, which starred Dustin Hoffman as an out-of-work actor so desperate for a part that he masquerades as a woman in order to land a female role on a soap opera. He falls in love with an actress on the set who doesn't realize he's a man. In the meantime, he's lost interest in his girlfriend, played by Terry Garr. In this scene, Garr asks why he hasn't been returning her phone calls, and she insists that he tell her the truth.
I'm going to tell you the truth, Sandy. I'm in love with another woman. Pretend it was something else. We're going to lose everything we have.
I never said I love you. I don't care about I love you. I read The Second Sex. I read The Cinderella Complex. I'm responsible for my own orgasm. I don't care. I just don't like to be lied to.
That's Terry Garr and Dustin Hoffman in a scene from Tootsie. Terry Garr, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. Nice to be here.
Now, you actually wrote some of your lines for this scene. You say in your book that the character was supposed to just get really angry and flip out when she finds out from Dustin Hoffman that he's in love with another woman, but that didn't ring true to you. Why didn't it ring true, and how did you change what the character said?
Well, I think it didn't ring true because what the character was supposed to be this independent woman. Of course, she was in the middle of trying to be connected to a man and truly connected to her career. So she was a little bit on the fence there. But I think initially, if someone said, well, I'm not in love with you, I'm in love with someone else, she goes, so what? That's got nothing to do with me. And I suggested to Sidney Pollack that I write something about it. I had done a lot of research about the feminist movement at that time. So I was reading all the books at the time that were Betty Friedan and Sherry Height had a book and all these. And I was reading all these books, and some of them actually made me laugh so much. But I said, well, if you let me do one take where I just can spew out all this stuff that I've been reading, I think it'll work.
And so you wrote all the stuff about
it. I did. And I did see that one line that said, I'm responsible for my own orgasm. And I remember when I read that was in Sherry Height's book. I went, what does that mean? I didn't even know what it meant, but I thought, well, I'm throwing it anyway because it's funny.
It's funny, and it's very of its time.
Yes, of its time is right.
It must have been fun to act opposite Dustin Hoffman in that movie. I mean, he's such a good actor, and you could really like work off of him, and you're shouting at each other and talking at the same time.
Yes, I really appreciate Dustin Hoffman. He really tries to get a reaction out of everybody. A lot of your actors don't like that. But, you know, I would be in a scene with him where we're coming out of an elevator, and they'd say, all right, we're rolling, and action, and the elevator doors would open, and he would pinch me in the butt. So that all the stuff that I had planned and all the stuff I was concentrating on was out the window. But in a way, it's a wonderful thing because it keeps you spontaneous and fresh, and, you know, the camera's catching something that's completely spontaneous. So I sort of loved working for him. I don't think Jessica Lange went for it too much. And I know that Sidney Pollack did. Stop it. Fooling around. But he's wonderfully an inventive, wonderful actor.
Do you think Hoffman's goal was to keep you in the moment and keep you fresh, or to just fool with you?
Oh, he's just a play kid, puppy. You know, he just likes to play. I think he does it. I saw him on an interview with Barbara Streisand recently for that movie, Meet the Fockers, and he was teasing her and driving her crazy. So he just likes to tease you, and he likes to see if anybody has got a set thing that they're going to do. He likes to obliterate that somehow, which is very childlike and charming, I guess. You know, I'll tell you one thing that happened during that movie that was interesting, is that Dustin told me that you could lose 10 pounds by going in the sauna. And I always... You know, what actress doesn't want to lose 10 pounds or 5 pounds or whatever? The longer you stay in there, the more weight you'll lose. I do it. Paul Newman does it. I mean, that's all he had to tell me. So I went, all right, I'm going to try this. So I'd go into the sauna. I'd stay 15 minutes. It was unbearable. Then I'd do it again for maybe 20. Then I got myself up to 40 minutes, maybe 50 minutes. And I would come out of the sauna and fall in a pile on the floor, just ruined and like a cooked shrimp laying there. And then, you know, eventually I would be able to gather my strength and move on. Well, here's what I find out later. This thing that, about MS, that it's these lesions that stay quiet in your body, the thing that exacerbates them, maybe the number one thing that exacerbates them, is temperature. So you try to stay out of heat, and I'm always aware of, acutely aware of heat. So here I was thinking I was losing weight, but I was actually starting up the MS during that movie. I mean, it's possible that that's what I was doing.
Wow.
But, you know, hindsight's 20/20.
Did you feel symptomatic during the movie?
Well, shortly after that, I got some real... Yes, I did feel symptomatic. I ended up in the hospital. I think that was maybe my first exacerbation right after that movie was finished.
Huh. Well, let me ask you about another movie you were in, and that is Young Frankenstein, or Frankenstein.
Frankenstein, yeah.
Yes, directed by Mel Brooks. How did you get to work with him?
Well, there was rumors going around town that there was a big movie being cast, and there was lots of girls going up for this audition, and I got my agent to get me in on it. 500 girls. When I went there, Mel Brooks said, we're casting for the part of the fiancé, the financière, he called it. But I want Madeline Kahn to do it. I just want you to know. But she doesn't want to do it because she doesn't want to do a comedy. But I'm auditioning all these girls. So I went in and I got a call back. And I was very excited that I even got called back. Finally, one day I got a call back and he said, Madeline has decided to do this part. But if you can come back tomorrow, I'll give you a chance to audition for the part of Inga, the lab assistant. But you have to have a German accent. Can you come? And so I got 24 hours to get a German accent together. And I did, because I copied Cher's wig maker, who had a German accent.
You were working on the Sonny and Cher show at the time.
Yes, I was working on the Sonny and Cher show at the time. And there was Renata Vestavigs.
Did you learn things about comic timing working with Mel Brooks on Young Frankenstein?
Well, I don't think you can learn comic timing. I think I must have innately grown up with, you know, my mother and father from vaudeville and stuff, and lots of jokes around the house. But I had been working on Sonny and Cher show as a dancer and also in these horrible comedy sketches. And I sort of had learned the comic timing then. Also, I was an incredible fan of Mel Brooks, the 2,000-year-old man. I had listened to those records hundreds of times as a kid and memorized them and did them over and over again. So I sort of knew his rhythm. But he is one of God's gifts to this planet. Mel Brooks is just the funniest man in the world. He is really funny.
What did he call you, a shiksa goddess?
Shiksa goddess, my long waisted shiksa goddess. No, and then he called Peter Boyle and I, come here, Trafe. We were both Trafe. I don't know what it means exactly. And then at one point,
not kosher.
I said, well, Mel, you're so wonderful. I wish I was Jewish. You're Jewish. You are a Jewish by injection. I don't know what he meant, but okay.
My guest is actress Terry Garr. Her new memoir is called Speed Bumps. Here's a scene from Young Frankenstein. Dr. Frankenstein has just been fooling around with his seductive lab assistant, played by Terry Garr. In this scene, his assistant Igor, played by Marty Feldman, has escorted the doctor's fiancé to the castle. The fiancé is played by Madeline Kahn.
I'd like you to meet my assistants, Inga and Igor.
How do you do? How do you do?
This is my financier, Elizabeth.
Oh, I'm so happy to meet you at last.
Finance.
Excuse me, darling. What is it exactly that you do? Well, I assist Dr. Frankenstein in the laboratory. We have intellectual discussions, aren't we? As a matter of fact, we were just having one as you were driving.
But I...
What?
What? Igor, would you give me a hand with the bags?
Certainly. You take the blonde, and I'll take the one in the tavern.
Oh. We'll talk more with Terry Garr after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actress Terry Garr. She's written a new memoir called Speed Bumps. You started off as a dancer.
Mm-hmm.
And among your accomplishments, you danced in 9 Elvis Presley movies.
I'm not sure that's an accomplishment. You know, some of these things are credits, some of them are debits, and that was filler.
Okay, movies that you danced in include, correct me if I'm wrong here, Viva Las Vegas, mm-hmm. all Elvis films. Viva Las Vegas, Roustabout, Kissin' Cousins, Speedway, Clambake.
Yeah, among others. Yeah, at that time he was doing about at least 4 movies a year, bad ones in Hollywood. But I had worked in West Side Story, you know, with the original cast of Jerry Robbins. So I was a really good, legit dancer. And one of the guys in the show became a choreographer for Viva Las Vegas. He said, you guys want to come down to this audition? So we went, well, sure, well, let's do that. So then once in those days, once you got into the union or the central casting, they just called you again and again and again. So I started, you know, going to all the auditions. I mean, I danced in Elvis Presley movies, but I also danced in Shirley MacLaine movies, What a Way to Go, and John Goldfarb, Please Come Home, a big movie. And a lot of other little movies that... that they just called me for. So that's how that started. I put it, it'd be like one step ahead of being a cocktail waitress that you could be.
Why? It sounds like so much fun to dance in an Elvis film.
Actually, it was great fun to dance in the Elvis movies.
What's the silliest number you were in one of the Elvis films?
Oh, man, they were all pretty bad. I guess in that clam bake thing, there was something about digging for clams and... Oh, man, they were all bad. But, you know, it was so funny because I grew up with my mother telling me stories about being a Rockette. She says, we had to do everything. We had to learn to play the violin one week and the drums the next week. And so she was always telling me how they were so versatile. So that when we did these silly clam bake and whatever they were with Elvis, I thought, well, I'm in the same boat with my mom.
Your mom was one of the original Rockettes.
Yes, she was. Mm-hmm. The original Rockettes. They were called the Roxyettes or something when she first went in there. I know the history of the Rockettes, believe me.
So, did you get to hang out with Elvis?
Well, a little bit. I mean, you know, I'm sure there's been so much written about Elvis, but he was out there like, you know, a fish out of water, and then he's in Hollywood making movies. And I also think he had a kind of a morbid fascination with his Colonel Parker and whatever he told him to do. You go to Hollywood, you make these movies. So there he was. And he brought all his boys with him, and they'd hang out on the set. And they said, you girls want to come to a party at Elvis's tonight? I went, well, yeah, okay. So we go to Elvis's, but he should have actually said, do you want to come and watch Elvis watch TV or something? Because that's more like what it was. But I was fascinated by the whole thing. I was fascinated by him. He was such a talented, you know, charismatic guy. And I looked at him, I thought, you know, he should be in front of an audience, not on the soundstage. He's just kind of wasting it. But anyway, I got to be kind of friends with him. You know, he was very funny. And I don't think people don't talk about that. He was really, he had a great sense of humor, very funny. I laughed all the time.
Well, something else you touched on, you were one of the dancers on Shindig.
Yes.
And which was, you know, one of the rock and roll shows. The bands would be there and there were dancers. You were in a cage, right?
No, they were called pods.
Oh, you were on like a pedestal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And what were the dances that you had to do? This was probably what, 67?
67 or 68. Well, they were called things like the Watusi and the Swim and the something like that. We also did mostly that same guy who choreographed Viva Las Vegas choreographed Shindig for a while. So we did some real dancing on that. Some numbers, we called them. I don't know. But
my impression from the book is that you didn't particularly enjoy that.
Well, you know, the minute I got into West Side Story and I had one line, even though I danced and I really wanted to be a ballerina and in ABT and everything, I had this one line and I got a reaction from this one line. I thought, I want to be an actor. I want to be an actress. Or, you know, I want to be in the front. I don't want to be in the back. So that's, I think when I got this thing about being on Shindig or Shivery was another one I was on. Well, I really can't be on these permanently. I'm busy. I'm going on. I mean, I had it in my head then that I was going to move on and out of the chorus line. So please don't tie me down to a series. I'm sorry. I can't do this.
One of the ways you made the transition from dancing to acting is that you got an agent who got you a lot of TV commercials. And that was your portfolio, in a way, for casting agents?
Yes, I was very lucky to be able to do all these TV commercials at some point. And I think that was a big learning experience, too, because in a way, you know, selling some product is acting. So I was studying acting, I was trying to do plays, I was taking dancing jobs, but I was also doing all these commercials and going on all these commercial auditions. And there must have been, you know, you could go on 6 or 7 auditions a day. So that's a great learning experience. I don't think people can do that these days. But I did a lot of that. And then I started making a pretty good living just doing commercials. I said I could phase out these dancing jobs. But I never did, not totally. I mean, it took me about 10 years.
Okay. Products you did TV commercials for include Crest, Safeguard, Soap, Greyhound Bus Lines, Camay Soap, Bold Detergent, Sure Deodorant, General Foods, Breakfast Squares. So many commercials, you have to look almost orgasmic as you taste the breakfast cereal or as you inhale the perfumed soap. Did you have to have that really kind of fake, like, wow, it's amazing expression on your face for the commercials?
Yes, always. I remember once I did a commercial for Metrical. Do you remember what Metrical was?
Yes, it was a diet fluid.
The diet fluid that you ate for lunch. So I was doing this commercial, and I was supposed to be in the teacher's lounge with Penny Marshall, was one of the other teachers, and I drank so much Metrical that I was getting ready to puke. And they said, and I heard them say, all right, get the bucket. And Penny and I both looked at each other, what do they mean, get the bucket? So I would drink some of the Metrical. They would pan the camera off of me. Then I would spit the Metrical into this bucket. Then they would pan back to me, and I'd go, delicious. Well, I want to tell you, it was very difficult to do without laughing, because you'd hear this noise, and then, fabulous, it's so delicious. Anyway, I had a good time doing many commercials. They're funny. Yeah, they kind of do them by the seat of their pants. But then in commercials, everything has to be done legally, correctly. And boy, I learned a lot about advertising. And
if you're just joining us, my guest is actress Terry Garr. And she has a new book. It's an autobiography that's called Speed Bumps, Flooring It Through Hollywood. Now, the first real movie role you got, like major movie role, was in The Conversation.
Right.
With, directed by Coppola, starring Gene Hackman. Like, does it get better than that starting a movie career?
I was absolutely in shock. I told you I was doing commercials at the time. So one of the commercial casting directors was casting his film. And she said, do you want to go up for this part? And I said, of course, I'd go up for everything. So I went and met with Coppola. And I thought that would be the end of it. I said, wow, you guys, I met Francis Coppola. Then a couple of days later, they said, they want you to audition. I said, oh, this is fabulous. So I went and read. Then they said, they want you to fly to San Francisco to do a screen test. And I thought, this must be some part. This would be like the lead in a Francis Coppola movie. So anyway, I flew to San Francisco, did this audition, and then flew back. He had me sing When the Red, Red Robin Comes Bob, Bob, Bobbing Along. You know, I have to say, Francis Coppola was one of the big influences of my life, because I think back on things that he had me do from the get-go and how they were part of the creative process. And he really taught me what that was about in a way. So anyway, I went to San Francisco and auditioned, and then I came back and, well, that's that. I've done a screen test for Francis Coppola. I'm putting this on my resume. I never thought I would get the part. So then I got the part. And they said, you have to be here tomorrow for the cast reading up in San Francisco, which I couldn't do because I was working on Sonny and Cher show. That's how much I had planned on getting this job. But I lied to them on the Sonny and Cher show and said I was sick. I couldn't be there. And flew up to San Francisco and read the entire script and realized that it was only one scene in the whole movie. But still, I wasn't going to turn it down. I was very excited to have been in it. And I think it was really great to have that be the first kind of recognizable part in a film, was in The Conversation, even though the next movie that to come out that I was in was Young Frankenstein, where it was all funny and all that, and it was a bigger hit movie. It still kind of created a balance there that this girl can act and be funny.
And it's an interesting scene. You're in bed, and Hackman, who's your boyfriend, walks in the door, and you want to get to know him more. He's this very closed, unknowable guy, and you keep asking him these questions, and he gets more and more closed the more questions you ask. So it's a pretty interesting scene. Why did Coppola ask you to sing Red, Red Robin in your audition?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think it had something to do with he wanted to see that character, if she could be, like, ingenuous and naive and just jump in and do something cute and sweet. I mean, looking back on it now, I see that. It was his fantasy. He always wanted to have a girl that was just in a room that would just be there for him, that didn't know anything about him, but that was happy and positive and not bitching about being locked in a room.
This was Hackman's fantasy in the movie?
No. Well,
you think it's Coppola's fantasy?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Well, the whole movie was his fantasy. It was more about his Catholic confessional thing of listening to what people were saying, and very interesting, revealing movie about the man who wrote it, who was Francis Coppola. But yeah, that was what that was about. Thank you.
So you work with Coppola not only on The Conversation, but on One from the Heart. And you suspect that it was during the filming of One from the Heart that when you had an accident, that it kind of started your MS.
Well, I do suspect that, but I could be wrong. But I think it's one of the reasons I wrote about it in the book is because I want other people that have MS to think maybe this something like this happened to them. But there's a theory out there that MS is a virus that's in you, but like everyone gets chicken pox or some kind of virus that stays and lays dormant. But some kind of trauma or some kind of something will exacerbate it. So I do remember dropping a broken champagne bottle, which is thick glass, on the top of my foot, and it broke, it severed the tendon in my foot. And I felt like it went boing in my head or something like that. And when I look back on that, I think, I wonder if that was the thing that started the MS, it activated it. You know, I could be dead wrong, but I did write that in my book because I thought that maybe was when I first started experiencing little, you know, things that weren't right. And I couldn't control my body as well as I could. I mean, here I was a dancer and a good one, and I just couldn't make myself do it. I thought, what's going on? Am I lazy and am I getting tired? And I think that's when it started to happen.
And the champagne bottle that you dropped, that was in a scene from One from the Heart.
Right. It was, I was supposed to be carrying groceries in, and then I dropped it and it broke on my foot. Right.
This is early in the film.
Yeah.
Yeah. Terry Garr's new memoir is called Speed Bumps. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of The Narrative of Sojourner Truth, an African-American Testament, part of Barnes & Noble Classics, available in stores and online. From Dial Press Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Esther and Ruja, How My Grandmother Survived Hitler's War and Stalin's Peace, by Masha Gessen. And from ESPN, presenting Codebreakers, an original movie on West Point's honor code and its football legacy, Saturday at 9 p.m. Eastern on ESPN. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The complete Library of Congress recordings of Jelly Roll Morton have just been released on CD. They feature Morton playing and talking. Coming up, Kevin Whitehead has a review, and we continue our interview with actress Terry Garr.
A peculiar soft love, a gown, with a heart that was mellow, and all around the fellow.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with actress Terry Garr. Her films include The Conversation, Young Frankenstein, Tootsie, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and Ghost World. She's written a new memoir called Speed Bumps. Part of the book is about how her life has been changed by multiple sclerosis. She announced that she had MS in 2002. She had symptoms years before she was accurately diagnosed. So what were your early symptoms? When did you start to feel like this is something you needed to pay attention to and take seriously?
Well, I don't. The symptoms, I always have this ego that I'm fine and I'm a perfect physical specimen, that anything that did happen to me, I sort of ignored it. Well, this is normal. Everybody gets this. But I know that one of the first things that happened to me was years ago, I'd feel like this buzzing in my foot, buzzing, like your cell phone or something. And then I thought, well, it couldn't be a cell phone because we didn't have cell phones back then. I mean, we had cell phones, but they were the size of canoes, so it wasn't that. But I didn't know what it was. And then it would go away. And then I had where I would run. I was a big jogger, and I would run in Central Park, and I would trip on something. I thought, what rock? What did I trip? I almost just went flying leap. And then that would go away, so there would be this tingling and maybe a stabbing pain in my arm, which was another thing. When you heat up your body by exercising and running, it seemed to exacerbate these pains, and it would make me be weaker. And then when I felt this, you know, stabbing pain in my arm in Central Park, I thought, well, maybe it is a knife because I'm in Central Park. But it wasn't. I would get those symptoms, and then they would go away. So by the time I got myself to a doctor and said, now, check this out, it would be gone. Because MS is relapsing and remitting. So the doctor would go, honey, there's nothing wrong with you. You're fine. You might feel a little crazy, a little hypochondriac. And I'm just sitting there like, well, maybe they're right. I guess I'm a hypochondriac. But I never had been a hypochondriac. In fact, I would like to stay away from doctors as much as I can, and not, I would go at the last minute. So by the time I get my butt to the doctor and he'd say, nothing wrong with you, I go, oh, now I've wasted so much time. I could be in class right now or something, reading. And so, not good.
How do you think being a dancer and being very attuned to your body and being taught to just kind of go on, because you always have aches and pains as a dancer, how do you think that affected your ability to cope with the symptoms of MS?
Oh, I think it was absolutely a wonderful thing to have been a dancer, to have that discipline, and to just to be able to roll with the punches and all the jobs that I did. And like I said, my mother teaching me that when they were a Rockette, they had to learn the accordion in one day and all that. It was something that I thought, it's why I call the book Speed Bumps. It was just something that made me slow down, go, MS diagnosis, okay, let's keep going. How my life had progressed, I think, was a great lesson in how to deal with an illness or a diagnosis. Because when you start out in Hollywood or in New York or wherever, show business, it's 99% get out of here, rejection, and you have to develop the hide of a rhinoceros, but you still have to have the spirit of a butterfly inside in order to do your art. So that really came in handy, because I went, well, I can handle this. I'll handle this MS. I don't know what it is. I'll deal with it. I'll find out a way to do it, and I'm going to go on with my life. And that's what I did.
On the other hand, I could see how being a dancer might have made you more bitter about having MS, because your body was such a well-crafted tool.
Well, that's a nice thing to say, but I've never been bitter, and I've never had I don't really have any negative thing. I had little things along the way. For example, I went to a doctor who said, now, you walking weakly on your right side, I could put a brace on your leg. And so he said, try the brace. I tried the brace. I walked up. This is fabulous. I'm walking around the office. This is wonderful. And then I looked. I said, I have to wear this all the time? He goes, yeah. I said, wait, you don't understand. I'm Terry Garr. I'm known for my fabulous legs. Now I've got to wear a brace on my leg. And he just said, well, it's a small price to pay. And it was instantly, I went, it sure is. I mean, I would be able to put it in perspective that I have to wear long pants or long skirts forever now, but I can walk around better. So it was one of those things where I was able to say, what's better, showing off my stupid legs or walking better? So I walk better.
Do you still wear the brace?
Oh, yeah. Cut it on right now.
How would you describe your walking now?
Oh, it's not good. I mean, I've gotten weaker. It comes and goes. But it's, you know, more than how am I walking is, it's my fatigue level. You know, I get really tired. For me to walk around the block is like someone climbing Mount Everest. And I think people who don't have MS don't understand that. So that it takes a lot of energy. But I walk a little slower. But, you know, I walk across airports and I do a lot of traveling, and people start walking fast and going ahead of me. I go, I'm getting there. It's slow but sure. And I try to keep a sense of humor about it and a good attitude. I mean, not to say I make fun of myself, but I try to make it easier on other people, because I always think it's harder on them than it is on me. I'm fine with it. I'm happy to be alive. But they must think, oh, you poor thing, you're suffering. And I'm not.
Now, your recent roles have included Ghost World. You were mm-hmm. the mother of one of the two girls mm-hmm. in the movie. And you were the mother of Phoebe in Friends.
That's right.
And so two mother roles. Mm-hmm. Are you still acting now?
Oh, yes. I just am on Law & Order. I play a defense attorney named Minerva Graham Bishop. Good name, huh? And that's a great job. I'm a defense lawyer on that show. I've done one. I'm going to do another one and perhaps more.
And does the MS get in the way of your performing?
No. How could it get in the way? I get in my way. I feel like I'm a little bit rusty. But no, it hasn't. You know, on the Law & Order show, there's a cinematographer who's quite brilliant. And he has MS. And so he had a little scooter, motorized scooter around the set. He said, "Do you want to borrow one of mine?" I said, "Sure." And that was great. See, that's one of the reasons I go around talking about living with MS and talking about MS is that there's so many myths about it and that people can go on with their lives and they can do good work. And I think the myth is, no, they're dead, they're out, they're gone, they're in a wheelchair. In fact, I was going to call my book, "Does This Wheelchair Make Me Look Fat?" But I was afraid if I put wheelchair out there, it's going to be another big, you know, check mark against me. So I'm trying to, you know, I try to keep it on the upper positive level that those of us with MS can still go on and still function. And I want the rest of the world to believe it. And I also want the people that have MS to believe it, because I think they're victims of the bad publicity, too. You know, that they go, "Oh, I have MS. I better throw in the towel and go to my room and watch TV or something." And that's no. You have to go on with your life.
My guest is actress Terry Garr. Her new memoir is called Speed Bumps. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is actress Terry Garr, and she has a new book. It's an autobiography that's called Speed Bumps, Flooring It Through Hollywood. Can we talk about your parents a little bit?
Please.
Your mother, as you mentioned, was a Rockette.
Mm-hmm.
She was, you say she had wonderful legs. She did, what, hosiery ads, too, to
she
show
did,
off
yes.
her legs?
She called herself Legs Lind.
And then she also was like a wardrobe person for several TV shows?
Yeah, I think a lot of dancers go into wardrobe afterwards. I don't know why that happens, but it's true. And yeah, she became a costumer in L.A. And my father died when I was 11, and he was in vaudeville, and they met in a Broadway show, my parents. And then he came out to Hollywood to be in movies, and that didn't pan out, and he became very ill, and he passed away. So my mother had to support three kids, you know, by her wits. And so she went and got a job in the studios as a costumer. In fact, she was a costumer on Young Frankenstein before I even got the job. And she told, "Don't tell anyone I'm your mother." I said, "What is this about? It's so weird." Anyway, I learned.
Why didn't she want anyone to know?
I do not know to this day. Maybe,
was it for her sake or your sake?
I don't know. But finally, I told Mel, I said, "You know that lady over there? That's my mom." He was so great because he's just a great guy. And he, "Well, bring her over here." You know, he was wonderful. I just don't know what her motive was. But she was a great, interesting woman. You know, she her parents came from Austria. They settled in Ohio. And my grandfather said, "Girls go to secretary school, and that's what they do, and you'd shut up and do that." And my oldest aunt did that. And my mother and my other younger aunt said, no, we're not doing that. They hitchhiked to New York when they were like 14 and 16 or something like that. My mother became a Rockette. No, maybe they must have been a little bit older than that because they were out of high school. And my aunt was a brilliant artist and a concert pianist and all this stuff. So they had some aesthetic that they were not going to do what my grandfather said. So it was always the early feminist, "We're doing this, we're going off to New York to take care of ourselves." And unfortunately, she married my dad. And that put the end of that. But learning from it was that you do what you want to do, and you independently go. You take care of yourself and don't depend on a man. I mean, that was the idea that I got when I was a kid.
And what about your idea of show business, watching your parents? Did it seem like a good life or a bad life?
Well, it did seem like a bad life. I mean, it seemed like not a fair life or a fickle business, you know, mm-hmm. and I think it's true. I just recently was reading the review of the Elia Kazan's book, and he said the same thing. He got older. He said, tell anybody that wants to be a director not to do it because they throw you away. Well, then Mr. Kazan is for everybody. Everybody's got the same thing, that you have a peak and then it fades away, you know. But so that goes with life, I guess. But I didn't think that the show business looked that fair. But I also somehow got it in my head that I was going to beat it, and that I was going to get in there and do it too. And I was very influenced by my mother when she worked at the studios, and I was young then, and I would go visit her and take the bus down and hang out with her. And it was so exciting to be at a TV studio where there was costumes and sets and people rushing around and music and orchestras. I went, well, I want to be part of this. I just want to be part of this. And then because my parents were in vaudeville, a lot of their friends came out to Hollywood. Everybody wanted to be in the business, and it didn't happen. So they opened dancing schools. So I got to have free dancing lessons in all these places where my parents, who had worked with a dance team in Philly and a dog act in Boston and this and that, they were all out there, either maitre d's or opening Orange Julius stands or something like that. A very interesting, eclectic way that the fringe of show business kind of settled in L.A. And I was in that world. But it was always out there, the show business thing. And he goes, well, it's there for you. You can try it. You can try. And I said, well, I think I will. I think I'll try. My two older brothers didn't want to do it.
Your father was a comic. Was he like a joke teller at home?
Well, I don't remember that too much. It's a very interesting thing about writing a book about your life. I seem to find a big, huge gap about, well, who was my father? And, you know, he died when I was 11. And most of the time when I was alive, until he died, he was ill. So I couldn't really talk to him too much, and I had to be quiet because Dad is sick.
What was his sickness?
Well, he had heart trouble. And when I was born, he was in, he was in a USO show in the South Pacific, and he fell out of a Jeep and broke his back. And ever since then, he was not well. And they brought him back to Long Beach in a cast that was from the top of his chin to his knees. It was just a horrible, they didn't know way how to treat a broken back. But something happened then, I think, that diminished his life. And he started having heart trouble, and he started having all kinds of things. And he was always ill. And he did character acting in movies. He did a movie with Marilyn Monroe. And I remember going to see that when I was a kid. And he kind of made a living, but he was always ill. So I don't think I had much of a relationship with my father, and therefore, I don't know who men are. I think it's something like that. I don't know.
Do you think that affected your relationships?
Oh,
that you
yes.
didn't know much about your father?
You know, I really do. And I never thought about it until I wrote this book. I always thought, just like everybody else, well, there's just not enough good men out there. But then I see people with relationships and able to have them, and I think, well, no, I think it's something else. I think it's your relationship to your parents that make you have relationships with other people or something like that. But it's been a confusing mess, believe me, that end of it. But I go on. Even though I'm much older now, I still think there's hope of finding someone interesting.
So you're not part of a couple right now?
Not part of a couple, no. Except me and my daughter, which is a good couple.
You've played mothers in a couple of recent roles, like I said, including in Ghost World and the TV series Friends. Are there people you've been able to pattern those mothers on? Because it sounds like your mother was very different from the mothers that you've played.
That's true. You know, most of the mothers that I play in movies, starting from Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Right. Suburban mothers.
Yeah. I patterned them after my sister-in-law, because my brother married his high school sweetheart, and my other brother married. They're both stayed married all this time, but my one sister-in-law is very Martha Stewart, and you know, she's my brother's a surgeon, and so she's a doctor's wife, and she's very knows about gardening and centerpieces and stuff like that. Something that I completely never grew up knowing, and I when I got those parts, I would think I have no role model, because the role model I have is more like the Texaco man or something. I mean, it's just, so I went and would look at what my sister-in-law did and copy her.
Have you ever had a part where the character had MS and instead of, you know, like covering symptoms that you may have had for performance, you were able to use them in some way?
No, I've never had a part where the character had MS. In the Law and Order that I'm doing, they said, do you want to be in a wheelchair? I said, well, I can't even run a wheel. I don't know how to do a wheelchair. And they said, but if you want me to, I'll use a cane. And they did. They wanted me to have some nonspecific. They never said it was MS. And then we never got a chance to use the cane. So I never did it. So I haven't really come up with that yet to play a part where someone has MS. But I think they did on West Wing. The president was supposed to have had MS. But, you know, it's a very ambiguous. They haven't really played it on any show, I don't think.
So in Law and Order, does your character have something?
Well, they never mention what it is because Law and Order is about the show. It's about their
story.
It's
not about the character's personal life.
No, I mean, you can walk in there with an arrow through your head and they go, well, we're just not going to mention it. But, you know, okay, well, all right. So they never mention what I have. But then again, I never even used the wheelchair, a scooter, or a cane.
Terry Garr, thank you very, very much for talking with us.
Well, Terry Gross, thank you for having me.
Terry Garr's new memoir is called Speed Bumps. Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews Jelly Roll Morton, the complete Library of Congress recordings by Alan Lomax. This is Fresh Air. In 1938, long after he was at the center of early jazz, pianist Jelly Roll Morton recorded 8 hours of reminiscences for Alan Lomax at the Library of Congress. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says it's one of the great oral histories and a picture window onto early jazz. He reviews a new edition.
Tell you, as I can understand, my folks were in the city of New Orleans long before the Louisiana Purchase, and all my folks came directly from the shores, or not the shores, I mean from France, that has crossed the world and the other world, and they landed here in a new world years ago.
So begins Jelly Roll Morton's account of his background, education, travels, and music, starting in New Orleans 120 years ago. Now that all Americans value that city's rich cultural heritage, Morton's epic Library of Congress recordings are out in a jumbo edition you can really lose yourself in. Nobody described jazz's early days with an eye and ear and memory as sharp as Morton's. Here he is setting up one of the earliest tunes any jazz band played.
The composer I've ever heard or ever was known. The name of this was named by some old honky-tonk people. While he played this, they sang a little theme to it.
Feeling neglected in 1938 and tired of seeing the wrong people get credit for creating jazz in the early 1900s, had approached the Library of Congress's barely paid folklorist, Alan Lomax. Jelly Roll wanted to set out the facts, recreating his own early music and that of other pioneers. To judge by outside evidence, Morton was a pretty reliable witness, despite his reputation as a braggart. You to brag, too, with a life like his. The great jazz composer and orchestrator was also a whorehouse pianist, pimp, pool hustler, patent medicine shill, rambler, and shady gambler.
Hold that tiger!
Alan Lomax's reputation has suffered lately for high-handed treatment of some African-American colleagues, and I wish he hadn't claimed sole authorship over the classic book Mr. Jelly Roll, the meat of it in Morton's own words. But they made good partners in 1938. Lomax was among the first to see the value of recording oral history and had the sense to sit Jelly at a piano. Morton had been honing his memories for radio and had a singular viewpoint on early jazz that makes it sound more like life in the Wild West than a magnolia-scented mansion. As he minds the story, Lomax keeps asking for sidelights, how people dressed and behaved, their songs and games and heroes. What we get are king-size characters and a panoramic view of a musician's world a century ago.
Make him a duke or a count, you see. Must be a member of the royalty. Mr. Jelly struck a jazzy thing in the temple by the queen and king. All at once he struck upon a harmony chord. King said, make Jelly a lord. Mr. Jelly lord.
Lomax recorded on acetate discs that needed changing every few minutes, and Morton quickly learned how to wait out the pauses and pick up where he left off. The soft piano he plays as he talks is a way of staying in the moment, but Morton often seems eerily aware of some future audience for this stuff. The showman knew he was giving the performance of his life in more than one sense. Describing a card game, he doesn't just sing a gambler's lucky mantra. He acts out the whole scene, down to the slap of cards on the table.
Okay, bet, bet. Roll up. Okay, roll up here. Two more on tray there. Okay, bet. I'm gonna get one and go the regular. So you want the thing over that 10 spot? All right, King, come up there. $10 more will catch King. Okay, boy, it's a bet. Okay. If I can make this one last, if I can make this card last, I'm gonna get one go to Reckley.
That must have sounded like voices from the grave, even in 1938. When I read the book Mr. Jelly Roll with my students last spring, we tried to imagine a perfect edition of all the Morton and Lomax material. The new box from Rounder comes pretty close. It includes two books, Lomax's and a good new one about the recordings by John Zwett, and a CD-ROM with a complete transcript of the sessions and other useful stuff. Morton's 8 hours of spoken, played, and sung history are presented on Expurgated, even when he's working blue.
Home, you dirty mother, the old you dirty son of a bitch, you bastard, you everything, and your mama don't wear no drawers.
But wait, there's more. In 1949, when Lomax was working on the book version, he sought out other survivors of the Golden Age, and excerpts from those interviews are here too. Lomax spoke to 71-year-old Alphonse Picou, credited with originating a clarinet solo so classic jazz musicians still quote from it. It was on the tune High Society. Picou even played it for him, one last echo from a lost world, one we'd know a lot less about if not for Jelly Roll Morton and Alan Lomax.
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas and writes a jazz column for eMusic.com. He reviewed Jelly Roll Morton, The Complete Library of Congress Recordings by Alan Lomax on Rounder Records. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from members of the American Institute of Architects, committed to designing sustainable communities that enhance people's lives. Good design makes a difference at AIA.org. And from Warner Home Video, presenting the series The West Wing, the complete fifth season on DVD, including two documentary featurettes. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Senator John McCain. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.